tonight. You thought you had had dessert already. That was an anti-climax. One of my functions, of course, is to introduce the people at the head table. I'm very fortunate tonight, I introduce only two. And it's difficult for me to say this, but these are the two gentlemen on my right. I didn't know there were two gentlemen on my right. On my far right, I guess I should call him Mr. Dan Rogge, because he wears so many hats that I'm surprised that he has only one head. Dan, we appreciate you being with us, and we now turn the ceremonies, I suppose, over to you. Dan.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our speaker tonight is Dr. W. Allen Wallace, president of the University of Rochester. I offer in his defense at a time when college administration was a reasonably safe and respectable trade. Not as it has since become, essentially a kamikaze type mission, best undertaken perhaps by a Japanese American. By the way, if anyone, including a member of the Board of Regents, wishes to propose a toast to President Hayakawa, in the words of Rowan and Martin, I'll drink to that. As you know, if you know him at all, Allen Wallace is that rarest and most to be prized kind of creature, a civilized man. He's a man of intelligence and great good sense, and I might add, one of my own very personal favorites in this mixed bag of conservatives and libertarians that we represent. And I know of no one in our midst better qualified by experience and by wisdom to speak to our general topic of the governance of institutions of higher learning than our speaker tonight. And so it is with real anticipation and with great personal pleasure that I present to you our speaker this evening, the President of the University of Rochester, Dr. Allen Wallace.
Thank you very much, Ben. In a speech that I made to our faculty and trustees at the University of Rochester in January, I discussed a characteristic that seems to me significant about the students who disrupt campuses these days. Not that I know very many of them. I will refer to these students following the eminent semanticist S.I. Hayakawa as disease for dogmatic zealots. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about the disease. Much of it's fascinating. It's drivel, to be sure, but it's plausible drivel. The hypothesis that I heard first, and this was about 5 years ago, was that the disease are starry-eyed idealists and intolerant of injustice and committed to social betterment. I heard that they are the children of overbearing, over-successful, self-made men and are reacting against paternal domination. And then I heard that they have been deprived of guidance, direction, and leadership at home. And others say that the DZs are simply following uncritically the guidance, direction, and leadership of their homes. A founder and past president of the SDS wrote, while holding an academic appointment at a Midwest college as resident activist scholar. that the disease were not spanked enough. Or did he say that they were spanked too much? If I'm not clear, it's because of anarchy in his arguments and participatory democracy in his participles. The title of his article, anyway, was The Spanked and the Unspanked. An eminent psychologist whom our students brought to the campus last fall said that the disease have grown up on demand feeding and instant foods, so they expect instant solutions on demand for whatever problems happen to capture their fancies. And the same speaker said also that some of the disease have a suicidal urge but lack courage. So they seek to cause destruction that will include themselves. At the Commonwealth University's Congress in Australia that I attended last August, the prevailing view was that the disease are mostly social science students. Now, the variety of these explanations makes it clear that they tell as much about the explainers as about the phenomenon, and that they are not much constrained by facts. Facts have a way of reducing disparity among prior assumptions. In theoretical statistics, a subject with which I used to be acquainted, some of the most interesting theorems deal with the rate at which beliefs, starting from disparate prior assumptions, converge in the face of evidence. A year ago, after 100 or so students at Rochester staged a sit-in for 2 or 3 hours, we made some simple statistical tabulations of data about them and compared these with data for the entire student body. It turned out that the sit-inners had a higher proportion female, a higher proportion from New York City, a higher proportion majoring or intending to major in the humanities, a higher proportion with highly educated parents, and a higher proportion whose fathers were in staff rather than line occupations. Now, obviously, there's a good deal of confounding in the data. Coming from New York City and having highly educated parents and having a father in a staff occupation all tend to go together, for example, so it's not possible with so few individuals to study the effects separately. But with regard to field of study, which has particularly interested me, it's not sufficient to use broad categories like humanities and social sciences. Very few of the disease are in those parts of the humanities and social sciences which are, as are the natural sciences and the professions, subject to external, relatively objective standards of truth, beauty, or goodness. The greatest intellectual feat in all human history will not win a Nobel Prize for a scientist unless it relates positively to the real world. The cleverest and most original new product will not win a businessman any profit unless the consuming public values the product more highly than they value the things used up to make it. Now, some intellectual activities are strictly disciplined by the test of responsibility. Responsibility for recording or predicting things accurately and for accomplishing things in the real world, where accuracy and accomplishment are judged by strangers. Now, these are often called hard subjects in contrast with soft subjects, which are judged by internal and subjective criteria of cleverness, brilliance, virtuosity, and above all, the satisfaction they bring to their creators. Each and every department, not only in the sciences and professions, but also in the humanities and social sciences, should be predominantly hard in this sense. It's around the soft spots, in whatever field they may occur, that the disease tend to cluster. The subjects in which the disease tend to be interested are consilient with their family backgrounds, which also tend to be removed from the discipline of direct responsibility for things that others judge favorably. It's not obvious that a lawyer, accountant, or public relations man for General Electric in New York City contributes to the health and happiness of tenant farmers in Alabama, though of course he does, And the children of such a staff man will not be as aware as will be the children of a waiter or a fireman or a surgeon or an engineer that what daddy does makes a difference in other people's lives. Just 150 years ago, in June 1819, Prince Metternich was engaged in correspondence with one of his principal colleagues, Friedrich von Gentz, about exactly this difference among fields of study. Gentz was an admirer and translator of Edmund Burke, who had written 28 years earlier that society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon the will and appetite be placed somewhere, and the less there is within, the more there must be without. Men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters. Well, Gentz wrote to Metternich that anybody can arbitrarily philosophize and criticize and think in poetic and mystical terms, but natural sciences have to be studied, and if only our youth will decide to study truly, they will be capable of intellectual discipline, without which our whole academic life is only a preamble to the wild anarchy which today fills all our political life. Metternich's reply to that letter from Gentz was prophetic. "I have never feared," he wrote, "that the revolution could be produced at the universities. Yet I feel certain that a whole generation of revolutionaries is being bred there. The greatest evil today is the press." Well, Metternich soon after imposed strict censorship on the press, and he also promoted natural sciences and technology in the universities, but let philosophical and critical studies atrophy. Now, Metternich's treatment of the universities 150 years ago has its counterpart today. The universities are about to be subjected to severe outside pressures to reform. But unlike the reforms that have come recently from inside, these outside reforms will not be aimed at having students take over functions of faculty and faculty take over functions of trustees and administrators. On the contrary, faculties will be accused of being greedy, treacherous, and irresponsible, and the public will demand that they make the students behave. The administrators will be accused of being witless, spineless, and irresponsible, and the public will demand that they make faculties and students behave. And trustees will be accused of being stupid, negligent, and irresponsible, and the public will demand that they make administrators, faculties, and students behave. Now, too few of the friends of universities will ally themselves with this movement to make it as beneficial as were the reforms imposed on Oxford and Cambridge by Parliament 100 years ago, especially in the Acts of 1854, 1871, and 1882. If your antennae have been tuned toward the Middle West and the Pacific Coast, or even Albany, you will recognize that this forecast is based on hindsight. The storm is already hitting some of the public universities. It is said that the Wisconsin legislature has before it some 70 bills aimed at curbing the state university. And the Board of Regents in California found itself last week just one vote short, Glenn Campbell tells me maybe it was two, of a major shift in the power to make faculty appointments. The New York legislature has passed two bills, one to withhold state funds from students who engage in violence on campuses, and one to withhold funds from institutions unless they file in Albany a set of rules of conduct, procedures for enforcing those rules, and stated penalties for violation. Now, something good may come out of those efforts, but there's something rather absurd about them. How could anybody expect that the universities can abruptly reverse a trend which has permeated American life for at least 35 years? The remarkable fact is that we have been immune from this for so long. We withstood it for some 35 years while it has swept the country. In the past 35 years, it has become commonplace to engage in the kind of tactics that our students are engaging in, sit-ins and violence, and coercive tactics of all kinds to get your way. And you'd be very hard-pressed to find any instance in the last 35 years where a group which has been willing to pursue these tactics has failed to win. And I think it's really amazing, as I say, that it hasn't hit us sooner in the universities. Last weekend, I was with a group of legislators in New York, and they were talking about these bills that they proposed to pass. And they said, we want you to, administrators or a group of university presidents there, we want you to understand that we're passing these in the hope of backing you up. Well, now I ask you, how absurd can you get? What value is there in being backed up by the legislature of New York or the governor of New York or the mayor of New York City, who are people who have knuckled under? They turn over and play dead when the teachers violate the law, when the garbage workers violate the law, when the social welfare workers violate the law. Without any exception, they've given in with no effort whatsoever at resistance. Now they talk about helping us. Of course, they're talking to their constituents. They aren't really talking even to themselves, much less to us. And here the federal government sits by idly while people travel around the country from one campus to another, openly and explicitly preaching revolution, teaching how to make Molotov cocktails, giving all the technical details of how to bring about arson and so on, and then they talk about helping us in the universities maintain order on our campuses. If they just maintain a little order in this kind of thing, our problems wouldn't be the same, and there might be some chance. So I think there's something really basically preposterous and absurd in all this public talk about how they're going to help you straighten out the universities and help them straighten out. And if I see some of them begin to straighten out their own affairs, then I might begin to look to them for advice and assistance on some of ours. Now, one of the things that's central to these problems on the campuses, the thing that's central to these problems on the campuses, is clearly the faculty. It's very rare when you hear administrators talk about these things, and that's what you hear most of the time when administrators get together these days. It's gotten so that if the telephone rings for one of them, everybody says, well, there's a sit-in at your campus, or a bombing. So there have been well over 100 bombings and arson incidents on campuses in the past year. They talk about it a lot, and I've hardly ever heard anybody mention students. The students are just a total cipher in the whole affair. Nobody pays any attention to them one way or the other. The entire issue centers around the faculty, but not in the way that I've been surprised to find some outsiders thinking. I find people like the legislators that I saw last weekend think that the role of the faculty is in inciting these incidents. Now, it is true that there always are a certain number of the faculty who are around inciting these things, who participate in the planning and the logistics and the tactics of trying to create disruption and disturbance on campuses, but at most of the universities, at any rate, they're a pretty small minority, and they're not really respected by the rest of the faculty, and they wouldn't make much difference. The real role of the faculty is not, the important role is not as inciters, but as tolerators of the violence, and particularly as being completely intolerant of any efforts whatsoever to bring it under control. They may vote, as the Columbia faculty did, by an overwhelming majority, that it's intolerable to permit the occupation of a building to continue. And I would say the logic of that is they voted, let's get the police, because there's no alternative to letting it continue and getting the police, or except maybe getting the National Guard or somebody even fiercer. But when the police come, they vote by an even bigger majority that it was absolutely intolerable under any circumstances to have called the police. And it's the knowledge that they will not even put up with the suspension of a student. Now, this is especially true of graduate students, where a lot of the trouble originates. Especially, no faculty member will put up with the suspension of his PhD candidate, some graduate assistant of his, or any student that he personally is acquainted with. So that there is, in fact, no possibility of discipline because of faculty attitudes. And that's the reason why you find the kind of tactic used at the University of Chicago, and we used in a similar situation, except it didn't last long. That is to don't call the police, let them occupy the place forever. It's best if they can be occupying a place, let's say, where the checks are written, the paychecks. Ours occupied the faculty club. And that's also advantageous. And we didn't, we just said we didn't care at all. I could stay and pass the word around the campus that the faculty better settle down to find somewhere else to eat for as long as 2 to 3 months, because we weren't going to negotiate with these people. We didn't see how they could leave in good faith without gaining something. And so everybody should settle down. So it turned out in a matter of 3 or 4 days, they were just dying to get out. And asking us, what can we possibly say to our parents to justify this, and so on, to show that we gained something. In this connection, I want to read you a quotation from Professor Albert W. Levy of Washington University in an article published last fall in a Washington University magazine. He says, "No university seriously interested in its own survival and mindful of its educational responsibility for the disciplining of lawlessness, dare refuse its obligation to punish those who engage in the tactics of disruption, especially those whose very political philosophies commit them to acts of violence rather than the legitimate protest which seeks for adjudication through responsible democratic processes. The escalation of outrage received in silence is a danger too enormous to risk, as we of the last generation have experienced it in the days of Nazi insolence before the invasion of Poland, when provocations were continuous and no resistance was forthcoming. David Lowe, the great British cartoonist, caricatured this infamous patience in a cartoon of Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, saying to the German Chancellor, 'Sir, you have starved my ancient mother, kidnapped my wife, raped my daughter, burned down the Houses of Parliament, and sunk the British Navy. But beware, Herr Hitler, someday you will go too far.'" And he continues, this was, as I say, written in the summer, published in the early fall. He continues, "I can see before me now the image of the tender-minded and perhaps conscience-stricken section of the Columbia faculty saying to Mark Rudd and his associates, and this time not hyperbolically, but in literal truth, 'You have seized 5 university buildings, barring students and professors from holding classes without their voter consent. You have broken into the offices of the president of the university, opening, ransacking, photographing, and making public his confidential files. You have held a college dean prisoner in his own office for over 26 hours, calling him to his face, names unprintable in the public press. You have burned the offices of 3 professors who have been unsympathetic to your strike, including the research notes of one of them, which were the fruits of 10 years of patient research. But beware, SDS, one day you'll go too far." Well, I think that is the critical role of the faculty, and the thing that's discouraging to a person that's been in universities literally all his life is the faculties seem to learn only the hard way, that is, only from bad experience and only from their own personal experience. They don't seem to learn from theories or principles or from history or even from experience at other institutions. In general, it's only after they have gone through the most extreme violence at their own institution that the gelatin of which too many of their backbones are made begins to gel. The faculty just simply cannot face up to the responsibility of having to discipline any student anytime for anything. And in some ways, that's consistent with the intellectual the standards and goals of a university, to tolerate anything in the way of diversity and differences of opinion. But with that inability to take practical action in a situation of this sort, faculties also have increasingly been claiming authority over all aspects of university operations, including student discipline. The whole approach to this problem of claiming power over university affairs by faculty or students talk of faculty power, talk of student power. All of this talk, if you, and writing, if you watch it, always talks in terms of allocating the fund. That is, who gets to push the button and have the fun of doing that, and who deserves it, is the entire kind of the criterion that's brought to bear in discussing problems of allocating power. And you never hear any discussion of allocating the responsibility. And in particular, you never hear anybody talking about will arranging the decision-making process this way lead to better decisions or worse decisions. That question isn't even raised. It's just who should get the fun. The picture is that there must be a panel of levers and buttons, and it must be an awful lot of fun to push them and watch the lights flash, and that some people deserve to share the fun. Some of this, of course, is a pervasive failure to understand society, and particularly to understand economics, which, of course, is a reflection on our teaching of the social sciences and of history in the colleges and universities. But a prevailing view is that the things that happen in society, particularly in the field of economics, the enormous torrent of goods and services that pour out on us, that they just pour, like Niagara Falls or rain in a thunderstorm. There's no notion that it has anything to do with arrangements by which decisions are made, but with human effort, that it's difficult to make those goods and services flow, and that to make them flow even faster is still more difficult. You find no conception of this in the university world in general. The picture is it just pours out, and the question is, what should we do with it? How should we divvy it up without any regard to the feedback? And correspondingly, an increasing tendency to turn almost all problems over to the government without any awareness, again, of the effect of that back on the quantity and volume of goods and services available and on the life of the society. Dicey, in the preface to the 1914 printing of his Law and Opinion in England in the 19th century, pointed out something that nobody seems to recognize yet. Namely, that there is an inconsistency between democracy and collectivism. He said that the ideal of democracy is government of the people, by the people, and in accordance with the wish of the people. And the ideal of collectivism is government for the good of the people, by experts, or officials who know or think they know what is good for the people better than either any non-official person or than the mass of the people themselves. Each of these two ideals, he said, contains something of truth, but each of these ideals may sooner or later clash with the other. Beliefs marked by essential inconsistency are certain to give rise to most serious, and it may be very practical, and embittered dissension. And one of the few interesting things about what's referred to as the New Left seems to me just that it is reacting unwittingly against the collectivism of the old left, against the contradiction between democracy and collectivism. But unfortunately, the new left has been characterized by muddle-headedness, irrationality, ignorance, and childish whining. It's like a baby screaming in its crib, as yet incapable of analyzing whether its discomfort arises from hunger or an open safety pin or a wet diaper or its own thumb in its eye. But from this screaming baby, there might mature, greater miracles have happened, a rational, competent adult capable of analyzing the constructive possibilities of an open society and capable of applying its analyses to reforming society. Ludwig von Mises, in a book on bureaucracy, makes comments along the same lines. This passage, incidentally, was brought to my attention recently by Henry Manny, one of my colleagues at Rochester that I think many of you know. Mises wrote, "In the decade preceding the First World War, Germany, the country most advanced on the path toward bureaucratic regimentation, witnessed the appearance of a phenomenon hitherto unheard of, the youth movement. Turbulent gangs of untidy boys and girls roamed the country, making much noise and shirking their school lessons. In bombastic words, they announced the gospel of a golden age. All preceding generations, they emphasized, were simply idiotic. Their incapacity has converted the earth into a hell. But the rising generation is no longer willing to endure gerontocracy, the supremacy of impotent and imbecile senility. Henceforth, the brilliant youths will rule. They will destroy everything that is old and useless. They will reject all that was dear to their parents. They will substitute new, real, and substantial values and ideologies for the antiquated and false ones of capitalist and bourgeois civilization. And they will build a new society of giants and supermen. The inflated verbiage of these adolescents was only a poor disguise for their lack of any ideas and of any definite program. They had nothing to say but this: we are young and therefore chosen. We are ingenious because we are young. We are the carriers of the future. We are the deadly foes of the rotten bourgeois and the Philistines. And if someone dared to ask them what their plans were, they knew only one answer: our leaders will solve all problems. It has always been the task of the new generation to provoke changes, but the characteristic feature of the youth movement was that they had neither new ideas nor plans. They called their action the youth movement precisely because they lacked any program which they could use to give a name to their endeavors. In fact, they espoused entirely the program of their parents. They did not oppose the trend toward government omnipotence and bureaucratization. Their revolutionary radicalism was nothing but the impudence of the years between boyhood and manhood. It was a phenomenon of protracted puberty. It was void of any ideological content. The chiefs of the youth movement were mentally unbalanced neurotics. Many of them were affected by a morbid sexuality. They were either profligate or homosexual. None of them excelled in any field of activity or contributed anything to human progress. Their names are long since forgotten. The only trace they left were some books and poems preaching sexual perversity. But the bulk of their followers were quite different. They had one aim only: to get a job as soon as possible with the government. Those who were not killed in the wars and revolutions are today pedantic and timid bureaucrats in the innumerable offices of the German Zwangswirtschaft. They are obedient and faithful slaves of Hitler, but they will be no less obedient and faithful handymen of Hitler's successor, whether he is a German nationalist or a puppet of Stalin. From Germany, the youth movement spread to other countries. Italian fascism masked itself as a youth movement. Its party song, Giovinezza, is a hymn of youth. Its buffoon Duce boasted still in his late 50s of his youthful vigor and was anxious to conceal his age like a coquettish lady. But the only concern of the rank-and-file fascist was to get a government job. In the time of the Ethiopian War, the present writer asked some graduate students of one of the great Italian universities for an explanation of their hostility to France and Great Britain. The answer was amazing. Italy, they said, does not offer enough opportunity for its intelligentsia. We want to conquer British and French colonies in order to get into the administration of these territories of the jobs which are now in the hands of British and French bureaucrats. The youth movement was an expression of the uneasiness that young people felt in face of the gloomy prospects that the general trend toward regimentation offered them. But it was a counterfeit rebellion, doomed to failure because it did not dare to fight seriously against the growing menace of government all-round control and totalitarianism. The tumultuous would-be rioters were impotent because they were under the spell of the totalitarian superstitions. They indulged in seditious babble and chanted inflammatory songs, but they wanted, first of all, government jobs. And if any of you have ever talked to students, not just the ones we've been talking about what their ambitions are, or their ambitions are to get a government job if they can't be a senator. Most of them would rather be a United States senator. Well, I have to say something about the role of the president of the university in all these goings-on. And by and large, it seems to me that the president stands alone. That is, if he stands, he stands alone. That sometimes his close associates are in close sympathy with him, but sometimes, as at Columbia, not even that. At Columbia, I think beyond any question that Grayson Kirk was all in favor of taking decisive action immediately, but not one single member of his top administrative team was in favor. And in those circumstances, of course, it was impossible to move. But otherwise, the president and two or three of his closest associates really are pretty much alone with no real sympathizers. There will be some sympathizers among the students and among the faculty, and of course, most outsiders will be sympathetic. But nothing can be expected from those people. In the first place, the students and the faculty who tend to be sympathetic are the ones that had a lot of research in progress, or we're doing a lot of effective studying, or in other ways we're being highly productive and having a very satisfactory career at the university. And they know that if they try to get into this fray, they will have to give all of their time for days and weeks to bickering and disputing and unpleasant relations, which may go as far as ostracism of their families even, and other unpleasantness. So they're very much inclined to, even if they're sympathetic, to sit back and hope that it'll all come out all right. Even in the case of the regents and trustees, the situation is complicated. Of course, in a state university, very often the regents have all sorts of political connections and constituencies, and they're talking to them rather than concentrating solely on the best interest of the university. But even in the private ones, there are complications that any member of the board who might step up and be effective in a dispute of this sort has other outside activities. He may be the head of a big corporation or influential in one, and they have unions and employees and relations with the public, and it's extremely important to them that they be thought of as a forward-looking, progressive, liberal-leaning, humanitarian, compassionate organization, and that they not get pictured as the bully fascist who summoned the police to conk the students on the head. And this is the way they'll be pictured if there is any activity of this sort on the campus. They will just immediately be portrayed as horrible people. And they have to stop and weigh their two roles, the one in the university and the one with regard to their outside activities. And then, in addition to that, they are likely to be subject to communications from people, faculty and others connected with the university, who say if anything like this is done, the whole faculty will leave, or the best people will leave, and what you've spent your life and generations before you spent their lives building up at great pains and cost and difficulty and slowly could be wiped out overnight. And of course, they don't know there's not a pigment of truth in that. It sounds pretty plausible to them. So that, again, even the trustees who looked at legalistically are the ones with whom the responsibility truly lies, are not likely to be, they're not likely really to sabotage the activities of the president, but they're also not likely to be any real support in one of these situations. And the president of one of the largest Middle Western universities, in describing one of these situations a couple of years ago, used the phrase that he felt completely naked, that he couldn't have named a single person in the whole state to whom he could have turned, or from whom he could have expected any effective support, and very few from whom he could have expected any sympathy. I think this is the situation at the present time. I don't think that the activities of the outsiders, the public, are likely to bring about, our legislators are likely to bring about an appreciable improvement. And yet, I'd say at the present moment, I'm reasonably optimistic about the university's calming down. One of the things that I think is important is that faculties, while it's too bad that they learn only the hard way and only by bad experience, and only by their own personal bad experience, still, maybe we should rejoice that at least they do learn from that. slowly, but gradually. And I think enough of them have been through enough of this and have seen enough of it at close hand, and particularly the demonstrations are turning against faculty and breaking up classes and destroying research, trying to bomb faculty members. So that I think there'll be a shift in faculty attitude. There will be a little bit more solidity or strength within the institutions for taking a stand. Then I think the change in the national administration will, I hope, and so far I think it is, moving toward calming down and restoring some kind of order and mutual respect and tolerance within American society. It's very interesting to me to observe the professional historians referring to President Eisenhower as an extremely weak president. And yet, if you compare the 8 years before his administration and his 8 years and the 8 years following, you find that the preceding and the following 8 years were periods of tremendous domestic turmoil and distress and of international insecurity and war. And I myself think that that had a lot to do with the way he ran the presidency and the conception he had of the presidency, and that he was a very strong president. The people who say he was a weak one mean he didn't do the things they wanted him to do, and he kept them from doing them either. And he had a conception of a society which the government is a servant to, and that the things to be done to improve the quality of society were out in the society for the most part, not to be done by the government and by elected officials, and that on the whole, a good deal of progress was made in that period, socially, race relations, economically, quality of life, cultural activities, education, all of these things. The actual record in that period is as good as in any before or after. The immediately following period is one of great turbulence, initially one of great style that appealed to the young, but somebody said the other day it was a period of the clothes without the emperor. And this was followed by a period of complete distrust and a feeling that everything was being manipulated, and whether there's any truth in it or not, this characterized the whole society. Well, I think the present administration understands this and that it's going about it, and so far it's off to a good start. It's certainly not going to get by without a certain amount of turbulence, but that will bring about some tendency to calming down the conditions that have agitated the universities. I think myself that far and away the greatest single source of the agitation of students has been the draft and the threat of, it's not the Vietnam War itself so much as the possibility that they personally will be picked up and sent out there to fight it, and that this in turn has taken its outlet in opposition to the war, and the president has moved yesterday towards replacing the draft of the voluntary army, as he had promised to do in his campaign. Then I think there's another fact that's been overlooked widely, and that is that these students that we're dealing with make these problems in the university are on the whole very exceedingly weak people. I don't know whether you have known any of them. On the whole, they're lacking in courage, and they're not willing to take a risk for anything. So that if they do get the idea that there is some slight risk in the activities they've been carrying on, I think they'll dry up rather easily, that it won't take a whole lot of spunk and determination within the universities, and that as soon as faculty opinions gel a little, which seems to me they're doing, that these stronger stands will be taken. And so in spite of all the things I've said, I'm actually reasonably optimistic that while there'll be more episodes, and they're very common today, that they will calm down within the next year or two. Thank you very much.
We need no exegesis at this time. If you don't know what that means, you can ask my friend sitting right there. He explained it to me. Although we need no exegesis, two things did occur to me as I listened to this very fine report on how it is. Alan Wallace, among many of his qualities, is a statistician. He wants the facts. And I was very much impressed at the beginning of his speech tonight with the fact that as soon as he learned that most of the agitators at the University of Rochester were girls, he decided to study broad categories. He also said that I do ask your pardon. He also said, quoting from an ancient source, that the young are carriers of the future. And the only carrier I could think of